I want to thank, of course, Dave Kreckler and Beth Brockmeyer for presenting today on this gambling topic. I think it's going to be great. It was a suggestion that we got from somebody, and it's not somebody who's sitting here. So if you have a topic you want to hear about, we can find speakers, but they would prefer to have a topic that people want to hear about. So if you have, even if you don't, if you're too shy or whatever to speak yourself, if there's a topic, get it to me, get it to Paula, get it to Anton Nikolai is our attorney coordinator, and we'll try to find a speaker for you. We're good to go for next month. We've got the Supreme Court review and preview with Tom Schreiner and Pete Blaine. And then in December, we have the bankruptcy ethics with Paula's Cookies here in Milwaukee with Mark Metz and Olivier Ryer. So if you want your ethics credit, free ethics credit, come back in December. It's December 8th. The November 3rd is a date change. It's to the first Tuesday in November, November 3rd. That's all on the website. And there is an issue with, I believe it's the Oshkosh location, in December. Rebecca's having auditors in, so you're not going to be able to go to Tom, or Rebecca Garcia, a.k.a. the old Tom King office, for your December video presentation. So make your plans now. Go to Green Bay. Those nice folks will be glad to have you. Come to Milwaukee. You can have cookies, whatever you want to do. Again, we're talking November for the Supreme Court and December for ethics. Thanks again for showing up for these. We appreciate it. Again, today is Dave Kreckler and Beth Brockmeyer. Thanks very much on gambling.
Good morning. I'm David, and she's Beth. And we're going to talk about gambling and bankruptcy today, which has been a very schizophrenic issue in American jurisprudence over the years. We legalize gambling. It's been an explosion of legalization, yet Congress condemns increasing consumer debt and the ease of discharge that we saw by BAP CPA. Not so long ago, gambling was against public policy almost throughout the entire United States, and debts weren't even enforceable. In fact, Len brought that argument at one time. We're going to start a little bit with the history of gambling. I was telling Judge Kelly that as I started getting into this, I got really drawn in because the history of gambling is pretty fascinating. It goes way, way back. The earliest thing I could find was 40,000 years ago. And there's these old dice that I found pictures of that are all made out of stone that apparently they said were gambling implements. I don't know that for sure. We do know that dice have been found in Egyptian tombs dating back to 6,000 BC. We know that the Chinese gambling dates back at least to 2300 BC, so that's more than 4,000 years ago. The Minoans played poker 1,000 years before Christ. And we know how that goes. I was just seeing poker last night on television. That's now a sport. Not sure how much exercise you get out of it. Playing cards were invented by the Chinese. They were brought into Europe, and they were Europeanized by into the current deck we have now, which has the king, the queen, the prince. The queen actually wasn't there originally. The French inserted her. French liked women. So gambling's been used for all kinds of things, and when we think about gambling in the law, gambling's been used to settle disputes for a long, long time. I came across the story of, I don't know if it's really Saint Olaf or King Olaf, I found different versions of this, but the story goes like this, that the Kingdom of Norway and the Kingdom of Sweden, and those of you that aren't geographically proficient, they adjoin each other. They have a common border that runs north and south. So the Kingdom of Norway and the Kingdom of Sweden had fought for a long, long time. But they had now made a peace, and they wanted to keep that peace. But there was this district that had been fought over and had changed hands and gone back and forth over the decades called Heising, which I may or may not be pronouncing correctly. So at times, Heising had been a possession of Norway and at other times a possession of Sweden. So the kings met, and they had to decide what to do with this division or section of land called Heising. And so they said to each other that they would cast lots, they would cast dice for that possession, for Heising, and the winner would get to have the district of Heising. So sweet, and by the way, both kings are named Olaf, which makes it kind of confusing. So Swedish King Olaf rolls, he takes the dice in his hand, and he rolls two sixes, which, by the way, the Greek, going long before the Olafs, the Greeks called that the roll of Aphrodite, the throw of Aphrodite. He rolls two sixes, and he turns to good King Olaf of Norway and says, "There's no need for you to throw the dice. I've thrown two sixes." But good King Olaf of Norway says, while shaking the dice in his hands, and I'm going to read this so I get the quote right, shaking my dice, maybe blowing on him, "There are still two sixes on the dice, and for the Lord my God it is an easy thing to let them turn up." And he rolls, and lo and behold, he throws two sixes. Olaf the Swedish king takes the dice into his hands, and again he rolls, and yet again two sixes come up. This is a fascinating fable. Good King Olaf of Norway, now three double sixes in a roll, takes the dice, throws them yet one more time, and one of the dice chips and breaks, and it becomes a seven. And ever since then, Heising belongs to Norway. So that goes back a long time, and the kings parted as friends, thanks to gambling, and that's how legal disputes got resolved, at least in that particular instance. So much for the Olafs. In the Middle Ages, gambling continued. It was pervasive. In the Middle Ages, dukes and kings had to forbid their soldiers from gambling because they found that they were shirking their duties. They spent all their time gambling. Kind of like a little trip to Pottawatomie or Ho-Chunk, huh? So where does all this come from, and how do we get this? And so I took a look at religious beliefs, because that seems to tie into our feelings about a lot of things and moral issues. And gambling, even with judges, has often been thought of as a moral issue in some regards. A 2011 study found that 28% of Americans believe gambling is morally wrong. I will tell you that that varies over history a great deal, especially in our country. The Bible does not condemn gambling. The Quran says that gambling is the 14th greater sin. It calls gambling a gross sin. It says we should avoid games of chance. Buddhism considers recreational gambling to be harmless, but it does include gambling among its six evils. And what I found interesting was that the reason it is one of the six evils, at least one of the reasons, is that the gambler's word is not relied upon in court. And there's some truth to that. I've had cases where my client comes in and tries to explain that I lost it all gambling, and you can just see the eyes sort of rolling up in the head. Some of you know how Judge Martin is, and he kind of looks up, and and that didn't go anywhere. So Hinduism and Christianity both, gambling is forbidden in the most strict of sects. In fact, one of my lawyers is a fairly strict Lutheran, and he's just told me that his congregation will not accept donations if they're the fruits of gambling. I didn't know that. I was brought up Catholic, and they had raffles every single week.
I'm Catholic. There's always beer, and there's always gambling.
Yeah, good.
Bingo, right?
And in Judaism, the Talmud refers to gambling as a sin. Despite all this, gambling is probably America's favorite pastime if it's measured by revenue. Sports betting is the most widespread of that, and the most popular form of gambling in this country. Estimates that I found range from $80 billion to $308 billion a year just on sports betting. That works out per capita to somewhere between $250 and $830 per person. In fact, on the news this morning, a big scandal in sports betting, FanDuel and, what's the other one, Fantasy, DraftKings, insider trading. People working at one would go to the competitor with the knowledge they had and were winning some nice amounts, apparently. There are more bets on the Super Bowl than any other single-day sporting event. That didn't surprise me. I did not know that Alabama is the biggest illegal sports betting state in the country, and over 90% of their bets are on football. We do know that Alabama is football crazy. I did not know that Americans spend more on gambling than they do on groceries. It's not true in my house, but apparently it is nationwide. Americans spend more on gambling than on theme parks, video games, spectator sports, and movie tickets all combined. So gambling is pervasive. It is everywhere in our society, and I know that I see it in my practice. When I began practicing, I didn't have anybody with gambling debts. They were few and far between. Today, all the time. I'm sure your experience is the same. But we are not alone. America is the world's largest gambling market, but our share is dropping as the rest of the world catches up to us. We were one-third of the gambling market in the world a decade ago, and now we're only a fourth. China, as its economy booms, has risen from 10th to the second largest market. Australians gamble and lose more than anyone else on a per capita basis.
Right.
Anybody here Australian? Well, whatever you are, I happen to have a little chart. I didn't do it in a PowerPoint, but I'll make it available. In fact, I'll pass it around the room here. So whatever your nationality is, you can look and see where you fall on the gambling index. Australia, Singapore, Finland, New Zealand, and then us. So I'll pass this around the room here just in case you want to see where your ethnic heritage falls on this thing. Yes, Susan, the Irish gamble.
Yeah, but the Dutch do not.
So with all of this, how does this tie into the law? Well, gambling is regulated. We all know that. Although the U.S. Constitution has no provision in it about regulation of gambling. So gambling is not one of the enumerated powers that Congress is authorized to do anything with. There would be exceptions, of course, for interstate gambling that would fall under the Interstate Commerce Clause, international gambling, of course, and Native American regulation. We'll come back to that. Wisconsin has a history, naturally, of dealing with gambling, although when we became a state in 1848, our Constitution forbade gambling. All forms of, the actual word was lottery, but that excluded all forms of gambling. The legislature shall never authorize any lottery. And that existed for over 100 years. The first gambling authorization in this state was in 1965. We had a constitutional amendment that allowed promotional contests. A few years later, charitable bingo that you mentioned was authorized. A few years later, a couple years later, raffles. So the Catholics could do their thing. 1987, we had the first state lottery authorization at the same time as we allowed racetrack betting, on-track betting. In 1987, and I had a hard time explaining this to my wife, she wanted to know why. She gets to hear all this stuff on Sunday mornings before you do, so she wanted to know why it is that the Indians, the Ho-Chunk, can gamble and we can't have a casino in Middleton, Wisconsin. And I explained to her it ties into U.S. Supreme Court decisions that said that a state cannot restrict gambling on tribal lands if it allows gambling on its own lands. And that's what happened in Wisconsin, is that we allow gambling as the kinds that I just mentioned. Therefore, the Ho-Chunk, the Potawatomi, whoever, they're allowed on their lands to have gambling. So that's the explanation for that. And in 1991, that's when we got the first tribal casino. So that's a little bit about American history, though, that I left off. And I know we're spending some time on this, but I think it's pretty interesting, and I think it ties in to the way the courts and the legislatures have looked at gambling. Our gambling history in this country has varied right from the very beginning. It's a schizophrenic thing. We had the Puritans in Massachusetts Bay Colony that forbade it completely. Most of the colonies had English roots, and in England, gambling was much more allowable. It was sort of a gentlemanly pastime, thoroughbred racing, for example. So in other colonies, gambling was popular and accepted. There are lotteries dating all the way back to Jamestown times in Virginia. In fact, it was private lotteries existing with the permission of the crown. Eventually, all 13 colonies had lotteries. So gambling was pervasive before we were even a country. They use their gambling revenue to establish universities like Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Princeton, Dartmouth, William & Mary. All of them, at least in part, can attribute their origination to gambling revenues. Gambling was used to fund churches back then. It was used to fund libraries. Gambling was supported by people like George Washington, Ben Franklin, John Hancock. So gambling, the political side of gambling in revolutionary times, was very pro. In fact, one of the gripes against King George was that he was restricting their gambling. So that, in a way, led to the country as it is. The first U.S. lottery came about, Congress tried to do a lottery to finance the Revolutionary War, but it failed. They weren't very good at it, kind of like, I guess, maybe the first website for the Affordable Health Care Act didn't work very well. The first lottery failed, too. They did pass a lottery to beautify Washington, D.C. in 1823, but it, too, failed because the owner, the person operating it, absconded with all the money, and the winner was never paid. So maybe there's a lesson there that Congress really shouldn't run lotteries. Horse racing has been around a long time. The first legalized track was in 1665 in Long Island. Casinos began in taverns and roadhouses, mainly with dice and cards. But we had lavish casinos here by the early 1800s. Gambling then moved west along with the frontier. Some historians say that the appeal of gambling is heightened by or akin to the frontier spirit. Both explorers, people pushing the frontier in America, and gamblers had high expectations. They were risk takers. They were opportunists. I don't know how much I buy that, but I guess I see some connection. New Orleans then became the gambling capital of the country. River towns up the Mississippi had a lot of travelers, and gambling was very popular with travelers. They have to do something at night. And professionals. This is where we started seeing the riverboat gamblers. You see them in the movies and the like. Riverboat gamblers, 1840, 1860, was their heyday. A lot of them were crooked. There were lynchings. The most at one time was 5 lynched on one day in Mississippi. So riverboat gamblers then, as the country expanded west, they moved to California. And San Francisco now becomes the gambling capital of our country. Meanwhile, lotteries are losing favor. A lot of them are become fraudulent and dishonest. There's sort of a pattern here. We want gambling. It always turns out to be dishonest and fraudulent. Think FanDuel, today's news, okay? And then we try to outlaw it, and then we bring it back, usually when we think it's going to raise money. So that's sort of the ups and downs of how this has worked. So lotteries are losing favor, and by 1840, they're banned in most states. By 1860, at the outset of the Civil War, only 3 states had lotteries anymore. Remember, all 13 colonies had them originally. That only led to the creation of illegal lotteries. At the same time, the gold rush is taking place. I mentioned California, San Francisco. So the pendulum is swinging out there, and it keeps swinging, and then it starts coming back. And California starts outlawing gambling because California doesn't want to be known as a reckless, gold mining, loose, lawless state. They want respectability like the East Coast. So they start outlawing gambling. And most type of gambling is illegal there probably by the 1900s. First slot machine came around in 1895. It was outlawed by 1911. By 1910, virtually all forms of gambling, think about what was going on in our country then. We had the temperance movement at the time. Virtually all forms of gambling were prohibited by 1910. Arizona and New Mexico had to outlaw gambling in order to gain their statehood. That was part of the deal for them. The Great Depression, though, changed everything again. And now the pendulum swings one a different way. The Great Depression led to bingo, horse racing legalization. There was no money, but people thought this was a way to raise money during the Great Depression. But there was a big crackdown shortly thereafter on the illegal gambling again. And that's where the mob comes in. The mafia, the mob, we all see stories and movies about that. So in the East Coast, they're cracking down on the mob. The mob moves west to California area, hence Nevada, hence what we know was the history there. In 1931, Nevada legalizes virtually all forms of gambling. Now there, and that stayed pretty much the same then for about 30 years. There had been no lotteries in our country from 1894 to 1964. But people were still gambling. I mentioned the Irish. The Irish sweepstakes was a big deal in 1930. The money, they were tickets. It was an Ireland lottery. The tickets were brought into this country. 13% of the U.S. population engaged in the Irish sweepstakes, with the proceeds going to help Irish hospitals. In 1964, New Hampshire brought back a lottery. New York did it 3 years later, New Jersey a few years later, and by 1978, New Jersey had legalized casino gambling, and I think we all know what's happened since 1978. So what about bankruptcy? How does all this tie into that? Well, New Jersey legalizes gambling in 1978. The bankruptcy code comes into effect in 78-79. At that time, there were 240,000 bankruptcies filed in 1980. We know what's happened to bankruptcy filings, and we know what's happened to gambling. It makes me wonder. It's kind of like the old adage, 24 hours in a day, 24 beers in a case. Coincidence? So,
I didn't know that was the old
gambling, bankruptcy, both going up exponentially at the same time. Now, I think there may be a change. I haven't seen gambling go down in the last 5 years, although we know that bankruptcy certainly has. So gambling's exploded, and today only Hawaii and Utah have no gambling. Only six states do not have lotteries. There is no conclusive evidence that gambling is a significant cause or even a significant contributing factor to bankruptcy, but there are a number of studies. I cited a few in the materials that think it does. There are other reports, including one from the U.S. Treasury Department, that says they do not find any correlation. I personally do find a correlation. And there was a Milwaukee Journal article. I don't see Dave Osbach or Virginia George here. Both of them were quoted in that article saying that they see anecdotal evidence. I certainly do myself. Some studies have shown that while we don't know for sure that gambling leads to bankruptcy, we do know that a significant number of problem gamblers, a significant percentage, end up filing bankruptcy. Studies range from 10 to 26%. A study by the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute found that 23% of Gamblers Anonymous members file bankruptcy. A study by the UST's office in the Northern District of Indiana found 20%. So, what motivates people to gambling? Social interaction, especially among the elderly. They find the bright lights, the safe environment. It's a safe place for widows and widowers to go to socialize. Other people find the risk, the thrill of anticipation. We already talked about the good King Olaf, that it can settle disputes. Speaking of settling disputes, one occurred to me last night as I was watching Monday Night Football. We start the game. We settle the dispute as to who gets to receive the kick with what? A coin toss with a gamble, a bet. There certainly are many social costs, but we're running out of time, so I don't want to spend more time on those because I could talk about this for a long, long time. Instead, I think we better get into the law about
gambling. Okay, now that David's got everyone pumped up, we'll talk about dischargeability. So now that you're awake, it's like the caffeine pump. So, of course, we all know there isn't anything that in the bankruptcy code that per se says that gambling debts are not dischargeable. You know, when a client comes in and you discover that there's gambling, either, you know, you're looking at their tax return or they're just honest with you, or, you know, I've had it where they start talking about it and their spouse looks at them like they have no idea this has been going on. That's never a good sign. But there's two things I immediately think of, and one is disclosure. You know, what are all the things that are going on? Where are we going to have to disclose this? And then the other thing is dischargeability. So there are two sections in the code where objections to discharge are usually brought. It's 523, where creditors usually bring an action to have their particular debt determined non-dischargeable. And then there's section 727, which results in the debtor losing their discharge altogether. Objections to the discharge may be brought by a creditor, the trustee, or the United States trustee. The cases that we're going to talk about today are all cases where the objection to discharge was brought by a creditor. I haven't had a lot of experience with UST, which I'm grateful for, but I think that oftentimes if the UST brings an objection and asks you to convert your case or let it be dismissed, you know, those are circumstances where I don't think there's a lot of cases, because I don't think, you know, debtors are often willing to, you know, pay the cost of litigation on that. So I think a lot of times those cases are just getting dismissed. Yeah. So I don't know if people want to talk about what's happened with them, you know, with the UST or not. But we don't see a lot of cases like that. These cases will demonstrate that it's very difficult for the creditor to be successful when the basis for their objection is gambling. The moving party has the burden of establishing non-dischargeability by preponderance of the evidence, either under Section 523 or Section 727. So if we start with Section 523, which is more common, the debtor is not entitled to a discharge from a debt for money, property, services, or an extension, renewal, or refinancing of credit to the extent obtained by false pretenses, false representation, or actual fraud. And then under Section B, which we'll talk about later, but that's where basically the creditor relies on a written statement given by the debtor. So over the history of these gambling cases, there's been a lot of different theories that have been applied, and there's a lot of crossover with the theories as well. So one of the issues with gambling debts is the issue of representation, because there is a lack of face-to-face contact between the creditor and the debtor, you know, when they're using their card at the casino or taking a cash advance, you know, from their bank, you know, ATM, and then going out and gambling with it. So one of the theories is the implied representation theory, where the use of the credit card is an implied representation that the debtor has both the intent and the ability to pay. Then there's the assumption of risk theory, where until the point of revoking the debtor's right to use the card, the credit card issuer is presumed to have voluntarily assumed the risk of non-payment. And then there's the totality of the circumstances, or a more objective approach, where the court is to apply a number of factors. And one of the leading cases on that is In re Doherty. And there's like a whole laundry list of things that, you know, puts the judge in a position of trying to apply all these objective factors, like, what is the financial sophistication of the debtor? Were the a bunch of charges made on the same day? It seems like a pretty onerous task for the judge. The common law or subjective approach is the approach that we're using in Wisconsin in most instances, and that considers the debtor's subjective intent at the time of the transaction, using the debtor's testimony and relevant circumstances. So Judge Utchick has a case, and hope I'm pronouncing it right, In re Breezy, and that case has also been widely followed in other districts. So a lot of these cases are fact-intensive, so I'm going to go over some of the facts. So in Breezy, Chevy Chase brought an adversary proceeding to have its debt determined non-dischargeable, alleging that Mrs. Breezy obtained credit through fraudulent intent. Chevy Chase sent the debtors a pre-approved credit card solicitation with a $10,000 credit limit. After a credit card check, they acknowledged that the Breezy's unsecured debt exceeded their two-thirds of their annual income, they carried large balances, and I think most importantly that they made timely payments. Mrs. Breezy obtained cash advances on her credit cards and spent them at the casino. Only after winning two jackpots totaling $33,000 did she calculate her debts and realize the magnitude of her problem. She used the winnings to pay some taxes, unsecured debt, and make a few home improvements. Then she took her remaining $15,000 and went to the casino in an attempt to pay off her remaining credit card debt. I've experienced that with clients where they thought, you know, if I just can get a big win, I'm going to be able to take care of this, or I'll be able to stay ahead of the curve on the credit card payments. It's part of the mentality that's going on. After considering the theories that we talked about, Judge Utchick looked to the Supreme Court's decision in Field v. Mann, and decided that the common law or subjective approach was the correct approach to use. And in Field v. Mann, the Supreme Court determined that actual fraud is the standard and that the common law factors for fraud must be applied. So the debtor must make a false representation to the creditor. The debtor has to know that the representation was false or at least recklessly disregarded the truth. And really the key one here that is really the hurdle for the creditor is that they have to prove that the debtor intended to deceive the creditor. The creditor, of course, must rely and suffer a loss as a result. Utchuk found that the creditor failed to prove that Mrs. Breezy intended to deceive the creditor. Mrs. Breezy had an honest, if questionable, and undoubtedly foolish belief that she could win enough to pay her debts. And furthermore, in Field v. Mann, Judge Utchuk saw that the creditors also proved justifiable reliance on the fraudulent representation. So Judge Utchuk found it doubtful that the creditor relied on the debtor's representation, mostly noting that credit check ahead of time, noting that the plaintiff chose to blindly ignore the warning signs and proceeded to extend the credit to the debtors. The next two cases are from the Northern District of Illinois. The first one is Citibank versus Michael. Citibank brought an adversary proceeding under 523, alleging that the debtor had borrowed money by fraudulent means. He traveled to Las Vegas and he gambled at blackjack tables. And the district court affirmed the bankruptcy court judge's determination under the subjective standard again. Michael had deluded himself into believing that there was a realistic possibility that he would win. Given his credit, employment, and family history, all of which were good, there's no reason to believe he didn't intend to use his winnings to pay his debt. Indeed, I believe the reason he changed his pattern of behavior to gambling more than ever was that he was trying to pay the large debts he had. You know, I'm thinking if I'm creditor's counsel, I'm just, you know, like, you know, in that situation, I'm blown back. Next, in the Murphy case, Chase and American Express brought an action alleging fraudulent intent under 523. Here, the debtor uses credit cards to finance his gambling on riverboat casinos, his golf game, and investment in stock options and common stocks. Again, the subjective intent test was applied, and the bankruptcy judge found that the debtor didn't commit fraud. The court finds at the time the debtor incurred the debts at issue, he intended to repay them and believed, however unreasonably, that he would have the means from his gambling and investments. The debtor had for years successfully relied on such income to pay off his credit card debt. As late as May of 1994, which was the year before he filed, the debtor was able to pay his credit card debt after making a profit in the stock market. The debtor did not significantly alter his spending habits in the months of preceding the filing of the bankruptcy petition. Rather, his betting didn't come through as it had in the past. So really, it's the judge looking to the debtor's intent and, you know, sort of a acceptance of gambling and, you know, the American Psychiatric Association, if I'm saying that correct, you know, has indicated that gambling is a disorder, and there's also some, I was reading some things that suggested that it's going to be, they're considering putting it in like the same group as like addictive disorders, like drinking and substance abuse. So I think the trend in society is sort of to recognize, you know, the mental illness part that goes along with this and the compulsive behavior of it. In the next case, the objection was brought under 523A and B, so we're dealing with a written statement again. The debtor was a frequent gambler, this has great facts, with Caesars organizing trips for him and extending him credit in the form of markers. On the first night of a trip, the debtor won $1.5 million, but lost $3.5 million on the second night. His losses exceeded the previous credit he was extended through markers. Per the debtor's testimony, on the return trip to Wisconsin, the pilot turned the plane around and the debtor was greeted in the hangar by a Caesars employee who presented a $3.5 million marker and told him he couldn't leave until he signed it. After an initial refusal, the debtor signed it under duress on advice of local counsel. The marker was presented to the debtor's bank and returned as no account was found. Peterson subsequently filed a lawsuit in Nevada District Court related to the hangar incident. And after Peterson's attorney withdrew, Caesars filed an amended counterclaim alleging fraud related to the casino debt. A default judgment was entered against Peterson for $2.6 million. Later, Peterson filed a Chapter 7. Caesars filed her summary judgment in the adversary proceeding, arguing that the bankruptcy court was precluded from relitigating the facts supporting the findings of fraud in Nevada court under the doctrine of issue preclusion. Judge Martin applied the Nevada issue preclusion law and denied the motion for summary judgment, finding that the law required that the issue be actually and necessarily litigated. Judge Martin determined the issue was not litigated, as Peterson's counsel had withdrawn, and Peterson was not aware of the amended counterclaim that asserted the claim of fraud. You know, in the case, you know, it kind of seemed like Peterson said, you know, his counsel withdraw, but also, like, he just lost interest and he stopped paying attention to the Nevada case. You know, he didn't get new counsel, he didn't try to defend himself, but in any event, that's how it worked out. The next case isn't a gambling case, but it deals with Section 523D, which puts the onus on the creditor even further. If a creditor requests a determination of dischargeability of a consumer debt under subsection A2 of the section and the debt is discharged, the court shall grant a judgment in favor of the debtor for costs of and reasonable attorney's fees for the proceeding if the court finds that the position of the creditor was not substantially justified, except that the court shall not award such fees and costs as special circumstances would make award unjust. You know, so if you're bringing a gambling case, it's pretty difficult to prove the intent of the debtor was to defraud, you know, and then you're going to get whacked with fees too. The court found there was no direct or circumstantial evidence of fraud intent offered under 523A2B. With regard to 523A2, the circumstantial evidence was found to be more substantial, but not enough to justify an adversary proceeding on its own. And the judge noted that the creditor didn't send someone to the 341 hearing, didn't do a 2004B examination. So it sounds like those things would be just like a minimum standard that needed to be done. And this isn't a case where the district court quote unquote said that the debtor veered dangerously close to fraud territory. So it wasn't a particularly innocent kind of debtor. The other section that we're concerned with for objections to discharge is 727, and this is where courts are asked to consider whether or not to deny the discharge of the debtor altogether. Judge Martin had the Ramos case. This is kind of, I think, this is a typical scenario, don't you think, the facts of this case? I think this is what I see and have seen in the past. Suppliers of the debtor's sole proprietorship fencing business brought an adversary proceeding. Distressed about his business, Ramos drank five nights a week and gambled regularly on cars and football. Admittedly aware of his insolvency, he closed the business, transferred the funds to his personal accounts. He applied the accounts receivable of the business to his personal expenses rather than business debts. In the last month that the business operated, $5,800 was taken in cash and checks and made payable to his wife. He agreed that his budget expenses were $1,100 a month and he had recreation expenses of $720 a month, which I think he explained was going out drinking, the $720 a month. No.
Well, yeah.
No explanation was offered for funds withdrawn from the business other than that they were used for personal expenses. He did not disclose any gambling losses or $1,000 that he received for the sale of a 25% ownership in a business on his statement of financial affairs. At trial, he testified that his gambling losses were probably more than $1,000 and hopefully less than $5,000 in the year prior to filing bankruptcy. Judge Martin addressed the allegation that the debtor made false oaths, and he focused on the non-disclosure in the statement of financial affairs, both for the gambling losses and the transfer of the business interest, and that in itself was enough to deny the discharge of the debtor. Finding those omissions sufficient to deny the discharge, he went on to go over the transfers of the monies between the business and his wife as, you know, what we more commonly think about is the intent to hinder, delay, or defraud his creditors.
You know, I've seen that before with Judge Martin on other issues. If you notice in Ramos, the creditor brought everything under 727, A, 2, 3, 4, and 5. It went after all of them. But the one that Judge Martin hung his hat on, the one that got him, was the failure to disclose. And we can never go wrong When I talk to my clients, one of the things in my interviews that I do with them is I ask them, what are the three most important factors in real estate? And they all know that it's location, location, location. And I explain to them that the three most important factors in bankruptcy are disclosure, disclosure, disclosure. And then I tell them about all the people that get in trouble for not disclosing. You don't get in trouble for what you do, you get in trouble for what you, for what you hide. And I bring up Barry Bonds or Roger Clemens or anybody that's in the news, because that's really what happens. And I've seen Judge Martin, I can think of a case with a lawyer who didn't disclose properly her fees, and she got hammered.
And I guess with gamblers, I mean, you know, the lying and the hiding from the spouse and the, you know, the lying is just sort of second nature, you know. So you really have to build a rapport with the person, and, I'm kind of like, you know, we're done with the lying. Yes, I know you didn't disclose this or that on this form or that or in the past or your wife doesn't know, but, you know, we're done with that now.
Well, that gets into what we were talking about earlier about the why do people gamble and also the social cost attributed to gambling. There's some amazing statistics about the number of people that contemplate suicide when they gamble, and I don't have that right here, but it's really, here it is, 80% of problem gamblers wish at one time or another wish they would die. 70% had thought of suicide. 55% of these gamblers had planned how they would commit suicide, and 23% had attempted it. Embarrassment is a big factor. So when we are not lawyers trying to fill out bankruptcy schedules and get discharges, but when we're acting in our role as counselor, which is part of what we do, we have to do some of that questioning with our clients.
With the chronic gambler, the obsessive gambler.
You mentioned Gamblers Anonymous before. Is it something that you refer people to, or are there other? I mean, I think you're beyond what a consumer bankruptcy lawyer is.
Mm-hmm.
Qualified to do with some of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need to tell people, like, you know, you're wrecking your life, you're wrecking your marriage, you're wrecking your family. You know, is that really where you want to go? I mean, like, the financial stuff is one thing, but, you know, you got to get some help.
Otherwise, you'll be my client again. So I find that the biggest factor is embarrassment. It's the same factor that I find just with credit card use. Or any kind of debt, is that it's usually when people are opposed to getting the help they need, it's due to an embarrassment factor. And we can help alleviate that. And we can identify using, and we need to do it anyhow in order to prepare their schedules. Because otherwise we could end up with a Ramos problem down the road and they could be denied a discharge. So how do you do this? Well, somebody mentioned earlier the firekeeper's card. Most casinos, if you're there as a regular, they have some kind of a card that you get. The firekeepers with Pottawatomie out in Madison, it's the Ho-Chunk Rewards card. Nearly every casino has a similar program. So ask if they have one of those things. That's a good thing to ask people. Look at their records. Look for their tax returns. If you know there's a gambling problem, if a relative, if the wife mentions it to you or they admit it, then you want to go back and take a closer look.
I think their bank statements are pretty, you know, gosh, there's $10,000 here.
Exactly.
Like,
so
where
if you
did
know,
that come from? Yeah.
If you know you've got a gambler, look at the bank statements. You want to get that information. Better that you get it than a trustee finds it later. Same thing with credit card statements. That'll tell you a lot sometimes. The bank records.
Well, they can take cash advances right at the casino.
Yes.
So
there are also online records, these fantasy sites, they all keep records, so you can get records that way if you really have to. Let's, in the time we have left, there's a few other interesting issues that I think relate here. Beth talked about the credit cards, and that's usually how we run into gambling issues, is that the debtor is taking cash advances on credit cards, but not always. She mentioned the Peterson case, and there was a marker signed. And a marker is, at least I think in most states, is a negotiable instrument.
It
is in Nevada. In fact, they prosecute those criminally, I believe, in Nevada.
And the Clark County District Attorney gets a percentage of the recovery from the collection of those accounts receivable. If you're criminally charged in Clark County with issuing a worthless marker, you have to be extradited from another, you know, it's a criminal, state criminal prosecution. You go there, they take them on plane or on cross-country buses, and there's no defense. The marker was worthless. The casinos make the majority of their profits from the biggest gamblers, these people who are issuing $3.5 million marker debts. They know that these people have addictive personalities, in most cases are bipolar, and they take advantage of them. And the fact, dischargeability of gambling debt. Gambling debts are unenforceable under Wisconsin law. That is a fundamental policy of our state. These casinos go after these people, take them as victims, and unfortunately, I lost the case. Judge Utchig issued this wonderful, wonderful decision looking at this, but under our choice of law rules, if a policy is fundamental, we will not, for example, it's clear, and Heath versus Elmer, Justice Heffernan said, no Wisconsin court would enforce a contract of prostitution, even though prostitution is, for example, legal by county in Nevada. So if a young Wisconsin woman went to Nevada, signed a one-year contract or something, we would not enforce that contract. But yet, we're having a discussion over whether casino marker debt should be non-dischargeable. I mean, that should not be occurring. The Seventh Circuit has said, well, there's a lot of contact with Nevada, but I think what we need to do at some point is get the Wisconsin Supreme Court to rule on this, because actually, although we now have conservative majority, is Governor Doyle who signed the gaming compacts, and some of the conservative justices were in the minority when those were upheld. I mean, the social costs of gambling, there are regularly suicides at Pottawatomie. They don't get reported. They happen all the time. But, it just doesn't go in the newspaper.
There's a lot of truth to that. And the case that Len is talking about, because he can't describe it ethically, but I can, is Jafari, which is also a multi-million-dollar gambling situation. I think in Jafari, as in Peterson, the casino actually brought a jet to Wisconsin.
Yes.
To bring the gamblers to Las Vegas. Is Nevada Clark County?
Yeah.
When you mentioned
yeah.
Clark County? Okay. So, yes, I don't know if prey is the word. I mean, these are people with a lot of money, so you would think they have some sophistication. But the casinos certainly make it easy to spend your money. They give these people penthouse suites and lots of free things. I don't know what they all might be.
And the information that I was reading from the American Psychiatric Association did suggest that the majority of people with this pathological behavior were bipolar. I mean, it's a very serious disease.
In the time we have left, I'm going to run through some basic things that we need to think about in gambling and schedules and just how we handle our cases. And the first would be our gambling, how does it become property of the estate? If a debtor wins and then files bankruptcy, of course, those winnings are an asset of the estate. And probably the only thing you're going to, unless you can engage in exemption planning, you're dealing with cash or cash equivalents. You have to use the wild card under federal exemptions, the only way to exempt it. If the debtor buys the ticket, the lottery ticket, or has placed his bet on FanDuel, or the bet is out there yet, and files bankruptcy, what happens? Well, the winnings are still an asset of the estate. The ticket is, and therefore the winnings are. And the ticket, or the raffle, or the FanDuel bet should be disclosed on the schedules. If the debtor files bankruptcy and then purchases the lottery ticket or makes the bet, what happens? Well, in a Chapter 7, that's the debtor's money. That all happened post-petition. In a Chapter 13, however, that those winnings are going to be an asset of the bankruptcy estate. We don't normally think of your decision in Wetzel as a bankruptcy case, but there was a bankruptcy component to that. In Wetzel...
I mean gambling.
Gambling, what did I say?
As a bankruptcy case.
Oh, yeah, I do think of it as a bankruptcy case. There was a bankruptcy court. We don't think of it as a gambling case because the big asset there was an inheritance. But there also was a gambling component, about $10,000 or so. And the the rationale applies to both, not just the inheritance, but also to the gambling winnings. And so that would be an asset of the Chapter 13 estate. We need to think about gambling with the means test. The UST, if you go and you look at their published guidelines, in both Chapter 7 and Chapter 13, their position is that net gambling winnings should be included in the income, net. Now, if that net gambling winnings is a lot of money, that doesn't mean that you're doomed under the means test, because I think that gambling winnings may very well be subject to a Lanning adjustment. Unless you're getting some sort of structured payment, you know, you won the lottery and you're getting $26,000 a month for a long time. But that isn't what most gambling winnings are. Usually you went and you went to Pottawatomie and you won $5,000.
Pay off your Chapter 13.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, if you really had that much, you're probably not in bankruptcy. But most gamblers get a one-time win and or a two-time win. They have lots of losses. So you probably don't have to worry too much about the means test. If you explain it all, again, disclose. I mentioned that gambling assets have to be disclosed on Schedule B. Gambling winnings have to be disclosed. And here it's not net. Here it's gross on Statement of Affairs question number one, or number two, the one with other revenue. Gambling losses get disclosed, though, on Statement of Affairs number eight. And I was going to tell you the Todd Max Haviland story. And Todd Max Haviland was a Wisconsin gambler who won the lottery, and I think I have his schedules here. He won the lottery and filed bankruptcy. I'm sorry, he filed a bankruptcy in 1998. And I think before his case even closed, it was a Chapter 7, I think it was about 3 months later, he won a lottery, a very large lottery. I don't have the exact amount of the money here, but a very large lottery. You know, we're talking over $1 million. In fact, he had the ability, I can tell you, I worked it out. It's almost $500,000 a year he went through between 1998 and 2014 when he filed his next bankruptcy. So in 16 years, Mr. Haviland went through close to $500,000 a month, $500,000 a year, not counting any interest, and of course taxes come out of that, so he really didn't have that much. But Todd, winning the lottery does not ensure no future bankruptcy, and that's a Western District case, by the way. Other issues, Chapter 13 issues tie in a lot here. Gambling and Chapter 13 just don't go well together. Judge Kelly in that Wetzel decision said, quote, "The debtor's use of post-confirmation income to gamble for personal entertainment while claiming they cannot dedicate an additional $700 per month in repayment to their creditors does not comport with the court's understanding of the philosophy of Chapter 13. There are other cases that you can find. I didn't find one where a court allowed a debtor, confirmed a Chapter 13 plan that the debtor was going to fund with gambling winnings. I don't know if we've ever had one here, but in Missouri, that plan was stricken down, and the court found it was unlikely to be able to fund your Chapter 13 that way. Good try.
Maybe temporarily.
Maybe.
Roll, right?
I couldn't find anything on any of the Chapter 13 websites except Mary Grossman, but Mary actually has some language in her website that says, gambling during your Chapter 13 plan. She says, gambling during the time you're in a 13 is inappropriate. You should avoid all types of gambling, and if gambling is a problem, she refers them to the Gambler's Hotline and to Gambler's Anonymous, both of which I have in my materials on, I don't know what page, but in my materials I have sites for you of how you can get there.
Apparently they have pamphlets, because I was talking about this with Steve McDonald, and he said there was a time where he just had a pamphlet in his office, and he would gently slide it across the table.
Not a bad idea.
Yeah.
We only have a couple of minutes. We're probably out of time, I guess. So I'll close with, don't be this guy. You know, you see those commercials. I'm Rob Lowe, and I'm crazy Rob Lowe, and I'm Peyton Manning, and I'm skinny-legged Peyton Manning. So I want you to not be this guy. Earlier this year, the Ohio Supreme Court permanently disbarred Ohio lawyer Stephen Becker for misappropriating funds, which he then used to gamble. His defense to the Ohio equivalent of OLR was that I'm addicted, I can't help it, and despite testimony from a psychologist that documented that Attorney Becker was a pathological gambler and may have been addicted to gambling, he had failed to seek help, so the court permanently revoked his license. Don't be this guy. Thank you.
Thanks very much to Beth and Dave for that presentation. It was wonderful. And I think it does apply to more than just gambling. I mean, the Wetzel case they brought up is obviously more than that. Again, I want to remind you about next month, November 3rd, it's a date change. The Supreme Court review and preview, there were a lot of Supreme Court decisions last year. You want to come. There were consumer ones, there were business ones, there was jurisdictional ones. You want to come and hear from Tom Schreiner and Pete Blaine on November 3rd. And then December 8th for your free ethics credit and Paula's cookies. And again, in Oshkosh, you want to make your plans now not to go to Rebecca's on December 8th. Thanks again. See you next month.